You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. We've got a great show for you tonight. We'll be recapping the second legs of the conference finals for the MLS Cup playoffs. We've got two interview guests, one with Sydney Hunt of Dirty South Soccer, and then one with former managing editor and co-host at Last Word on Soccer, Joe Hoynacki, from SBI Soccer, to preview the two teams in MLS Cup. But first, let me introduce my co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
I am doing wonderful, actually. It's a good day in Kansas City, put it that way.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts to Patrick Mahomes and Sporting Kansas City being winless with him at Children's Mercy Park? And how this may implicate as far as the consumption and sales of ketchup in the greater Kansas City area.
I will say Sporting Kansas City are not winless with him in attendance. He came over the summer when Sporting Kansas City were down 2-0 to the Houston Dynamo to come back to win 3-2. He's been in there multiple times actually this year. Big little bro. I won't say it's a budding bromance between him and Daniel Shalvey, which is actually really cool. Chiefs players, Royals players come in all the time. See Brett or George Brett around every now and then through the summer, especially. Get those summer evening games. Royals maybe played in the afternoon. Get a bunch of the Royals and sometimes even some out of town guys. I think last year we saw Corey Kluber and Yan Gomez, I believe, in the locker room there in Kansas City. So that was really cool. You get a lot of people that come in and out there, but I will say it's kind of crazy because after the first half was over, I walked out to go to the bathroom in the press box there, and the luxury and private suites all share the same bathroom with like the entire press box. As I was going to the bathroom, all of the Chiefs players were coming out to go to the bathroom, and I literally ran into Travis Kelce, and the amount of size difference between he and I is just. Was absolutely mind-blowing. But, it was cool to see all the Chiefs guys there. I will say, we'll say that Sporting Kansas City they haven't won since Anthony Sherman led them in the I Believe chant, which they should end the I Believe chant anyways, but that's not going to get me a whole lot of love around here.
Noted. And then making a triumphant return to Last Word on Soccer, current manager of the Little Men in Red up in Michigan, Robert Kerr. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I managed to peek my head out from the local scene and parenting responsibilities to put out an MLS article and join you fellas tonight.
Excellent stuff. So guys, let's get into it. In this segment, folks, we will be recapping the second legs of the conference finals. Atlanta United, technically a loss to New York Red Bulls, but I think certainly a good performance, very lackluster. Hashtag that's so Metro from the New York Red Bulls. And then Portland Timbers outlasting Sporting Kansas City. We will start chronologically and geographically in the Eastern Conference. Dan, I thought that the second leg at Red Bull Arena was a fairly boring affair. Atlanta took care of business and was very defensive, and it took a good 65 minutes for the New York Red Bulls to actually wake up. I mean, is there anything else that we can say nuanced about this, or what?
No, I really because we all got to the press box pretty early for the Sporting Kansas City matchup. A lot of us were watching it together. I think Jeff Carlisle and a few others were all kind of sitting around eating our meal beforehand, watching the game, and I think without 15 minutes into it, everyone just got up and went back to their seats in the press box because we kind of knew it was nothing interesting is going to happen here. It was a pretty upset. I won't say upsetting. The whole series, I think, is upsetting from a New York Red Bulls standpoint. Pretty disappointing in how they approached the first leg. Because, you know, if they had gone about it a different way, maybe they get a better result. Things kind of go differently in the second leg. Maybe Atlanta forces themselves out a little bit to try and get that away goal on their end, which could have left more for the New York Red Bulls to kind of open up. But I thought the Red Bulls did a really, or I thought Atlanta United did a wonderful job of managing the result in the second leg. It wasn't pretty. They lost the game, but it doesn't matter because they won that first leg so handily. And I think you go back to, if you're looking at the whole series here, you know, you go back to that first leg and the Red Bulls just completely shot themselves in the foot. I know Chris Armas is going to, you know, hold true and stand by his decisions and all of that. But man, decision got wrong. Sometimes you get them wrong. And that's exactly what happened there. And it cost them. And I think the whole game state of the second leg just did not play into the Red Bulls' favor. And like you said, I mean, they, even in their attack, you know, I feel like Atlanta did a good job. Not entirely bunkering and taking on tons of pressure in the final third necessarily, but managing the type of chances that they were giving the Red Bulls. And it was, the Red Bulls were going to have to string together four or five perfect passes to get through, break the lines of Atlanta and get a clear chance. And like you said, it took them almost 65 minutes to do that. So, Atlanta's plan was great. For managing a result, they lost the game. I don't really care. They advanced. They were the better team over the two legs. And if you're a Red Bull fan, I'm sorry that you continue to be disappointed, but, I think the whole series just got a lot of frustrations for Red Bulls, and their fans, and I think rightfully so.
Took the words right out of my mouth. Robert, anything else that we can say about the second leg, or shall we move on to the more interesting Western Conference affair?
I think I'd say that was after the first leg of the Red Bull Atlanta. That was kind of a lame duck, if you call it, second leg, especially with the third goal. And my takeaway was I was actually glad that Joseph Martinez missed that chance in the first 30 seconds, because then it would have been farther, farther, farther beyond doubt. And then, yeah, to Daniel's feeling, like after 15, 20 minutes when they didn't really look like they're close to scoring, it looked like a done deal from the get-go.
Absolutely. Let's move on to the Western Conference affair. A fantastic 3-2 win for the Portland Timbers on the road at Children's Mercy Park. Dan, you were there, and kind of similar to the first leg, I'm kind of awestruck and struggling for words to make sense of what happened. You know, the first leg was, I would say, goalless chaos, and the second leg was, you know, was a scoring fest of chaos. Walk me through what happened, how you experienced it, and how you made sense of, you know, the craziness in Blue Hell this past Thursday.
Yeah, that was a heck of a matchup. I mean, the atmosphere was incredible. I will say that supporting KC supporters in the Children's Mercy Park, they put on a heck of a light show thing that they did beforehand. That was awesome. Got everybody pumped up. Video beforehand was great. Got everybody pumped up. And the first 20 minutes was just all Sporting Kansas City. You get that goal from Daniel Shalloway, and you think Sporting Kansas City are pretty much well going to coast. All they really needed to do was bag one more, and I thought the result would have been pretty much in doubt. Too far in doubt for the Portland Timbers. And then Sporting Kansas City got their second and it got called back. Rightfully so. Ike Opara was offsides. He interfered with the goalkeeper. That's just how that goes. The question that I have maybe is whether or not the ball is in the back of the net. Regardless of Antonella attempting to make a play on that, I think that's an argument that should be in there. However, like kind of like the NFL does their pass interference stuff. However, I don't really think that that was there's not wiggle room for that in the rules in soccer. So there's your answer on that one. So if for the rule that it is, it's probably the right call. My question again is whether or not the goalkeeper was going to get to that regardless. That seemed pretty high up there and up into the top corner. But that, like I said, that rule thing is only in the NFL. So, you move on to it. Sporting Kansas City, Diego Rubio. I had a lot of Sporting KC fans that were actually really confused and kind of hitting me up on Twitter about it. Why was Diego Rubio's goal called back for the foul? I don't think any of them realized that Diego Rubio was correctly called offside on the play. Right there is like at the beginning of 43rd minute or so there, where he got played in and finished, to make it where everybody thought it was 2-0. Mark Dyer called it back correctly for the foul, because when you have simultaneous instances of offside or a foul being committed, the foul is this more serious offense, and so you call back and you play that foul, because that is it's the advantage is always played to the attacking team when it comes to, so, you know, and that's, you think baseball, tie goes to the runner type thing. The advantage will always be played to the attacking team there. So if the foul, occurred at the same time or before the offside call was made, then you can pull, then the referee pulls it back for that. So a lot of people thought they were pulling back the goal for the foul and not allowing the advantage to be played on, which was incorrect. He was actually playing the correct advantage to Sporting Kansas City. Actually, I'll talk about it later. I thought Geiger had a really good night as a referee. The only thing I had an issue with was Eric Valentin not getting a second yellow, which I definitely think he deserved. But move on from there. So the second half, Sporting Kansas City came out flat-footed. You saw it towards the end of the first half after that disallowed goal, the Diego Rubio's disallowed goal there. You saw Sporting Kansas City kind of starting to, their midfield was starting to get pulled in and out of shape. And then they weren't really closing guys down, and they were, Portland was starting to get some life into the game. They didn't make the halftime adjustment, or they were told to by Peter Vermees, and players even said that, you know, we told them at halftime to do it, but the goal from, to close down the Portland players, but, you know, Sebastian Blanco makes that shot from distance. I think Jeff Carlisle talked about it in his article on, after it. It's a quote that I've heard Peter Vermees say in practice multiple times. And he said it again after the game, is that if you give good players time on the ball, they become great players. And in practice, I'd say it was one of their last open practices of the postseason was again before that second leg of Real Salt Lake. He was screaming at them to close down the space and close down the players. And his words were, if you don't close them down, you turn bad players into good players and good players into great players. And I think that's kind of what happened. Not necessarily bad players, because I think Portland's got pretty much all good players, but, you know, you give space and time to Sebastian Blanco. He's going to make that pass and flip it over the top to Ibo Bise. He's going to rip that shot from distance and place it in the corner. Good players can do great things when they're given time. That's exactly what happened on both those plays. Sporting Kansas City goes down 2-1. Entire stadium shell-shocked pretty much after a whole dominating 45 minutes or so, and Sporting Kansas City fall asleep for 9 minutes. You had Geiger pull everybody off the field as one fan in one of the sideline sections decided to throw something at a player. I believe every other fan in that section kind of pointed out who it was, and the fan was arrested, according to reports that I've heard. I think they took care of that one pretty quickly and got the guy out. Peter Vermees said post-game that's the first time he's ever seen it in Kansas City and hopes it's the absolute last time. Joseph Hernandez got a goal as a substitute, came on to make it 2-2, but as Sporting Kansas City were pushing for their third, they did not get the third, and Portland ended up countering them and advancing, celebrating at Children's Mercy Park. It was really cool. I thought the game itself was just a really crazy, wild ride of emotions and momentum highs, and I think that's what happens when you get that second leg that is like it's all to play for both teams. I think you were missing that in the Red Bull Atlanta game where both teams really had all to play for and they had to go for it. I think that's what kind of contributed to both Sporting Kansas City and Portland's gameplay, and how that game played out was both teams were forced to go for it. There was nothing from the first leg that they could rely on. So that, you know, it became a one game playoff, it became a one game final to advance to MLS Cup final. So, it was an incredible, incredible night in Kansas City. And no, Sporting Kansas City were really upset and frustrated with how it played out, but, you know, Portland deserved the result. They handled everything correctly. You know, Sporting Kansas City, yes, the most dominant team, but in the way things go in a final, if you can't keep the other team off the board and then make the right, you know, capitalize on your chances, you know, you're going to lose. Sporting Kansas City definitely had the more chances and had the better chances, but they did not, they didn't take advantage of all of them.
A very thorough and complete review as always, Daniel Sperry. Robert Kerr, how did you experience the second leg between Sporting and Portland? And do you have anything else to add in terms of the outcome and why things happened the way they did?
My viewing experience was a bit more removed from the action than Mr. Sperry's. I actually was falling asleep at the couch at halftime, so I had to pick it back up on Friday morning. And when Blanco scored that second shot, the rocket shot, I about lost my cereal. That really woke us up. I was watching it with the kids in the morning, and it was really quite a shot. It was quite a moment, a game-changing moment you don't see every day. And the thing about that I really liked was that for the first time, at least me watching Sporting Kansas City, they always seem very in control, and they're doing their thing, and they have their style and method. And they pretty much 99% of the time are always sticking to it unless there's some adverse circumstances. But after that goal goes in, they're out of their comfort zone. They have to go for it. You know, they're, you know, throwing attacking players forward like I've never seen it. It was so exciting to see them, the team, I mean, obviously the Western Conference's top team, and seeing them go in an all-action mode was really, really exciting. And just the way the whole game played out was fantastic. And I can't remember too many times when I've had this, when you see the head coach have to like shush down the home fans. That was an interesting thing to see too. And then with Daniel was very thorough on that, on just the in and out actions. I agree that I think the only refereeing error that comes to mind is Valentin should have had many yellow cards in that game. They were pretty lucky not to lose him earlier. But I think, yeah, just so exciting. And then you were saying the first Red Bulls game had the goals, and then in the Western Conference, the second game, it almost reflects back on how exciting would it be if these were just one-game contests.
No, absolutely. I guess the only thing that I'll really add on this one is I think this playoffs, and in particular these two conference finals, were all about which team was going to put their best players in good positions to be their best players and make the critical plays. Soccer is a game of extremely valuable moments. As you know, anybody who reads my writing when I'm doing like a full stats breakdown of X goals or anything, you know, I think the question is, you know, would you rather have 101% chances to score a goal, or would you rather have one chance that is, you know, maybe a 99% plus chance to score a goal? And I think, you know, the Portland Timbers, I think you could argue over the course of the 180 minutes, you know, maybe he didn't have all the ball, maybe he didn't create as many chances or get as many numbers into the box, but they had more of the big opportunities, and those big opportunities were given to some of their biggest players. You know, say for the Sebastian Blanco strike that, you know, I think, you know, might have been an under 5% chance of going in, but if you put your critical players in a chance to be your best players and make the big plays, then you're going to be more successful, even if the other team has more of the ball or a greater number of chances. You know, I don't think that there's any doubt that the Portland Timbers holy trinity of Diego Chará, Sebastian Blanco, Diego Valeri were more dangerous over the course of the 180 minutes than some of the best attackers for Sporting Kansas City. And well, Dan, I agree with you with some of your analyses about what Daniel Shalloway and Diego Rubio and Johnny Russell have meant to this team. You know, on a pound per pound basis, if I'm just taking the three players most likely to score on either side, I would put money on the Portland Timbers before I put money on collectively any of the you know, the core, however the rotation goes with what Peter Vermees is doing. So Sporting might have had more chances, they might have had more control of the game, but ultimately they lost it, and that created opportunities. And, you know, chaos is a ladder, and the Portland Timbers climbed it against the Seattle Sounders, and they climbed it against against Sporting Kansas City. And I think they're in a decent position to, you know, give Atlanta United some fits on Saturday in MLS Cup just by the fact that they're going to give them the ball. We'll close out this segment. Dan, I'll throw it to you for last words. We've kind of turned some of these playoff series recaps into an impromptu post-mortem analysis of all the eliminated teams. Your thoughts on what the offseason projection looks like with Sporting Kansas City now that we know, now that they've made the announcement regarding their contract option decisions for 2019?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a big thing, is that I think Sporting Kansas City believe that their window, is a little bit longer. If you look at, their roster decisions, the only player of note that's not coming back next year is Kyrie Shelton. I will say I am kind of sad to see Christian Lobato go. He really started to come on for Sporting Kansas City, scored a goal, played well, was very dangerous at the first part of the year, then had a very serious injury that has kept him out for the rest of the year. I don't know if they declined the option on his contract because he may literally not be able to play soccer again. That was one thing that we've been musing about, but he's a very, very good player that was just starting to kind of come into his own and fit in to the team. But, you know, this team had a lot of new faces in very key places in the attack, and they went out and set the team record for goals scored, and they're returning literally every single player that started in that match against Portland Timbers on Saturday on Thursday. Daniel Shalloway will be a year older. You know, last year Daniel Shalloway was, oh, maybe is he this breakout player? Well, he went and led the team in scoring as a 22-year-old when they didn't even think of him as a first-team option going into the offseason. So a lot of good things happened for Sporting Kansas City this year. You know, they went and got to first place in the Western Conference. I think every single player outside of, you know, the core back line guys is in their prime. And I would still consider some of the guys in the back line that are older to be in their prime. As we know, defenders and goalkeepers kind of have a bit of a longer life in MLS and in sport and soccer, period, than the attackers and maybe the midfield. So you're going to be returning, you know, a lot of guys that are between, you know, 24 and 27. I think the Sporting KC average age for next season will likely be around 26, 27, which is, you know, a giant group in their prime. So they've got a lot to look forward to. And the only player that is not locked up for 2019 and beyond is actually for 2020 and beyond is Diego Rubio. His contract ends after next season. Kyrie Shelton was technically his contract was up. You know, Sporting Kansas City made an offer, kind of snarkily poking at the MLS rules explanation and called it a bona fide offer, as they were the only team who wonderfully used that in their press release on the roster decisions. But you know, if there's anything Sporting Kansas City do this offseason, is probably going to be some depth pieces. I expect a depth midfielder that can kind of play as a box-to-box midfielder. They don't really have someone else who can directly fill in for Roger Espinoza, at least, and at least not have a very high-level drop-off. Juan Cusain is another one of those guys. You know, they do have Jimmy Medrano who can play there, but I think he's going to be the first-choice left-back. They may try and bring in one more center-back who's kind of on the fringe as a depth thing. We'll see if they try and do that with the draft. And then I actually wouldn't be surprised if they really continue to pursue a big-time striker. As much as Diego Rubio has looked good in Kansas City, and as you know, they have a lot of striker options with Christian Namath, with Diego Rubio, with Kyrie Shelton potentially. You know, I think they're still missing a just pure out-and-out goal scorer on that front line. And if you know, if Diego Rubio wants to use that as motivation to keep pushing up his level, I think that'd be great. I think he's a solid player. But I don't know if he's the right player to correctly do everything in the Sporting Kansas City system. I think they'd love a player who's a little bit more like Kyrie Shelton, but that can actually take some chances and can score and stuff like that. We'll see what happens though. If Sporting Kansas City returned this entire team next year, with some depth options, you best believe that they will be, an MLS Cup contender again in 2019. And I have no doubt about that one.
Listeners, we'll be right back where I'll be interviewing Sydney Hunt of Dirty South Soccer to talk about the Atlanta United side of MLS Cup 2018. And then, former co-host of this podcast, Joe Hajnacki, of SBI Soccer. And then Dan, Robert, and I will be right back. I will be back after that in the roundtable. We'll see you then. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com. My name is Matt Pollard, and this segment will be doing a deep dive into Atlanta United FC and their prospects of hoisting MLS Cup 2018 this coming Saturday. To do that, I've brought in a soccer friend and writer for Dirty South Soccer at SB Nation, Sydney Hunt. Sydney, how are you doing, my friend?
Hey, doing well, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you very much for joining us. So, first of all, we've had a couple days to digest what went on last Thursday in the Eastern Conference Finals. Atlanta United ultimately going through off a fantastic result in the first leg. Red Bulls weren't themselves, but Atlanta took care of business and looked good doing it. In doing so, your thoughts on Atlanta United making it to MLS Cup this year?
I think you're right. Atlanta United really looked good, especially in the Eastern Conference Finals. I think getting that 3-0 win at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, of course, in front of their home fans, really put, you know, the Red Bulls into a tough situation. Ultimately, one that, you know, they weren't able to dig out of. So that pretty much left it for Atlanta to just, you know, defend and really not make any mistakes in the back, and they'll be home free. As it turned out, they were. Leandro Gonzalez Perez, I want to spotlight him first off. Just a terrific performance in leg two. Franco Escobar, the forwards, midfield. Jeff Lorena was providing that steady veteran hand at midfield. Really helped Atlanta United. Again, not a high-pressure situation, especially with the 3-0 lead in, on aggregate on the return leg. Obviously, it wasn't a deficit that couldn't be turned back. But again, they did their job. As you said, Red Bulls weren't themselves. Looks like Chris Arnold really got away with what worked for them in the regular season. I think that's what really hurt Red Bulls.
Absolutely. Let's turn on to what's going on this coming Saturday. Of course, a little bit of news with everything with Atlanta United. I'm normally not one to like speculation just based on visual appearance, but, you know, Miguel Almiron came back from injury for the start of the playoffs, but to my knowledge hasn't played a full 90 minutes. Jose Martinez was stretching out before getting subbed out in the second leg, and then, of course, you had Michael Parkhurst coming off but immediately said that he's fine. How busy is the Atlanta United training staff going to be, and what are the expectations as far as everyone's availability going into the final?
Yeah, I've not seen any indication that Almiron or Martinez will be unavailable for Saturday. So from what I figure, from what I've seen, they should be good. My concern would be with Parkhurst. You know, he did suffer that injury late in the second leg, as you mentioned. From what I've seen, though, with him, it doesn't seem like he's that serious. Carlos Bocanegra, after the match, morning after the match, said that Parker should be fine for Saturday, but at the same time, they're cautiously optimistic as to what his status will be. So we'll have to wait and see. We'll have to wait to see what the report for the training ground is. He is available. He has been made available to the media this week, so that should be some good news. For the most part, Atlanta should have a clean bill of health, especially among its starters. This reserves the special players, particularly Brandon Vasquez and Romario Williams. They may be out. As far as their main players, the regulars and the 18, those should be good to go.
Assuming that Parkhurst isn't able to go, or, you know, let's say that he's not 90 minutes fit, how does that change up what Tata Martino might be looking at tactically? Or, you know, would you... the presumption based on last week on Thursday is that it would be Miles Robinson subbing for him in the back, yes or no?
Yeah, that's the big question. If Parker isn't ready to go, do you put Robinson out there? The problem with it is, you know, Robinson, I believe, has only had one start to his name. So the big question is, would putting him into MLS Cup be a tough ask for him? So that'd be interesting to see. That wouldn't be my first choice in particular. My thought would be maybe a three-man back line of maybe Garza Gonzalez Perez and Escobar, then maybe a five-man midfield featuring Lorenowitz Rometty, sort of in the midfield role. So that would be my first thought. The issue with that is the 4-3-3 has worked so well for Atlanta United this far in the playoffs, so I think the mentality will be, if it ain't broke, they'll fix it for Tata Martino and his staff. However, if Parker isn't ready to go, that's something that they'll have to measure as that time comes on. But again, from what I've seen, for the most part, I think he should be ready to go on Saturday, but again, you know, it'll kind of be that balancing act, whether you want to start a player in Miles Robinson that isn't as experienced as Michael Parkhurst, or go to the three-man backfield and maybe risk shaking up what's worked so well this postseason.
Absolutely. Let's get into the tactical look of how the teams are going to play. I feel like it's pretty straightforward what Giovanni Savarese and the Portland Timbers are going to be doing, especially against a team that's probably more talented than them. Back to front, certainly playing on the road in a raucous Mercedes-Benz Arena. Won't have any issues with the turf, as they'll be familiar with that surface for what they deal with at Providence Park. But, you know, I would expect, you know, a thorough low block. Diego Char is going to be doing a whole lot of roaming, and the Timbers are going to try and work on the counter. A lot of what really worked for Atlanta, especially down the stretch, was their ability to sort of have a mid-block in the midfield and then allow Miguel Almiron and Justin Martinez to do their work on the counter. I presume the Timbers will be giving Atlanta United most of the ball in the final. You know, how do you see that sorting out in terms of Atlanta's attack versus Timbers' low block and vice versa?
Yeah, my colleague Rob Esri actually wrote about three positional battles that would be important for Atlanta United. One of them was Diego Charo versus Eric Rometty. Of course, when these teams met in the regular season, Eric Rometty was not yet a part of Atlanta United. So that's a big piece of the puzzle for Atlanta here in this matchup. How can he deal with Diego Charo in the midfield? Will he be able to shut down Charo and take him out of the equation? That back line, as I mentioned, Gonzalez Perez going up against Liam Ridgewell. Ridgewell himself has said that, you know, this hasn't been my best year. So it'll be interesting to see how Gonzalez Perez handles Liam Ridgewell. Again, if you look at Gonzalez Perez's this playoffs, he has just been unbelievable. I think they're going to need that from him again in this MLS Cup final. When you look at the midfield matchup, the two midfielders, of course, Almiron for Atlanta United and Valeri for Portland. Will they be able to unlock the shape of each team's formation and really get up into the attacking third? For Almiron, will he be able to create chances for Joseph Martinez, as he mentioned? If you're looking at it from an Atlanta United standpoint, I think your most important spots will be, again, as I mentioned, Almiron, Remedy and Gonzalez Perez. Those are the three players I'm going to watch for them if they're there to have success in the MLS Cup final. The fourth player I would look at is Franco Escobar. Just a very strong performer at that right fullback position for Atlanta, especially in that first leg. I think it was his best performance of the season, a well-deserved man of the match performance for him. So that's kind of a wild card that I'll be looking at if Atlanta are to be successful in this match.
Absolutely, I agree with you there on that point. Let's get more to the atmosphere stuff. Maybe, you know, not off the field, but certainly still in the stadium. Mercedes-Benz Arena has been an absolute fortress for Atlanta United. We've seen the spectacle that it's been used for in a playoff game this year and last year. You know, the All-Star game earlier this summer. I presume that it's going to absolutely be lit. Your thoughts on really what the, you know, what the home field advantage brings to that? You know, what the fan support is going to be looking at? Are they going to find a way to cram another five people in to set another attendance record on Saturday?
Yeah, that 12th man will definitely be big for Atlanta United in the stands. Tickets are, you can see in the ticket prices just how high they've been hyped up. You can see how much they've been selling. I believe it's already been a sellout. It's been announced as a sellout. Or if not, it's really, really close. They'll definitely break the record for most attended MLS Cup final. And I think that atmosphere will be tough for Portland Timbers to handle. Obviously, it won't be the, I want to say it would be the most intimidating atmosphere they've been in, because they've obviously played in Seattle in that Cascadia matchup. But it'll definitely, I would think, be among the loudest they've ever been in. So I think, again, that 12th man, if that crowd, which should be heavily Atlanta United slanted, can really get behind its team, really make things uncomfortable for Portland Timbers. I think Atlanta will benefit very much from that.
We've seen some fantastic TIFOs from the Atlanta United supporters over the course of the 2 years that they've been in MLS, and a spectacular, I would say, you know, a full stadium one with all the colors. I don't know if it was fabric or, you know, if it was just like really, really shiny paper, what they did, you know, with the black, the red, and the gold, incorporating the entire right. stadium in the first leg of the Eastern Conference Finals was fantastic. Do you have any word on, you know, is there going to be some big spectacular display in pregame leading up to the match?
If I know the supporters groups like I do, I think whatever they did in the first leg of the Eastern Conference Finals will top what they did. I mean, they'll top what they did on Saturday, what they did for the Eastern Conference Finals. Obviously, I have no idea what will happen. Nobody else does except the people making the TIFOs, so that can be a surprise that we'll all learn on Saturday, but I'd imagine they'll be pretty big. Like you said, Atlanta United fans have put together some really impressive TIFO. And I can't wait to see what they have in store for Saturday. I'm sure the league can't wait to see what they have in store for Saturday. The players, I'm sure, can't wait to see what they'll have in store for Saturday. You know, a lot of the Atlanta United players said after that first leg that they never seen anything like they saw in leg one. You know, they're just blown away by that. So, how will the supporters groups top that? I don't know, but I'm sure they will.
Absolutely. I'm sure it is going to be lit with a capital L-I-N-T. Let's go on to maybe what the implications could be for this final for Atlanta United. Obviously, Tata Martino is going to be coaching his last game at the club. Winners get paid in MLS, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of contract bonuses and other things that are going to be that either have already been activated or going to be activated upon winning MLS Cup. We saw that, you know, Toronto FC last year wasn't quite able to keep their full core of an all-star team together, so presumably there are going to be some players moving on. And then, of course, there's Miguel Almiron, whose future seems up in the air with, you know, multi tens of millions of dollars of transfer fees being putted around in the Twitterverse rumor mill. So, you know, there, you know, on one side of it, I look at it as saying from afar, Sydney, I see Atlanta United as being the standard bearer of everything that has been MLS 3.0, from big money expansion teams coming in, engaging in an alternative market. You know, a lot of people, myself included, were certainly naysayers of Atlanta United, citing all the things that had gone wrong on and off the field for the Atlanta Silverbacks when they were in the NASL and other iterations. And so you look at it kind of a culmination of what has been a fantastic building of a team from front to back, a number of fantastic coaches and players, some of whom might not be back next year, and certainly, you know, putting a standard bearer, you know, planting the flag, or should I say the giant golden nail, and saying, you know, we're here, we are now we're the flag bearers for what MLS is capable of being in MLS 3.0. What would MLS Cup mean for the club, the status, the players, the coaches, the fans, etc.?
No, you're exactly right. I think if they are to win MLS Cup, well, that will really solidify them as a club that has, like you said, put forth the model that will work in MLS 3.0. I think the big question is, you know, can teams like Cincinnati, can teams like Miami, can a team like Nashville, can they put together that same model, or will they go back to, you know, maybe that model that has worked in the past, maybe not the big spending model, but maybe the more tactical model, bringing in more tactically minded coach, players that really fit their philosophy. So I think with the three expansion teams coming up, we'll have to see what model they take, whether it's Atlanta's model or another model, or set the tone themselves. But yeah, I think that'll really secure, really confirm a legacy for not just the players, but for Tata Martino, for the technical staff, for the front office, certainly Darren Neal's president and Arthur Blank. I think it would really solidify their legacy here in the city. I mean, I'm sure you're very familiar with how Atlanta United, or how Atlanta sports teams have fared in championships in the past. Not very well. But can Atlanta United be that first team to really break through and really be the one to hold up that trophy? And that remains to be seen. And we'll obviously find out on Saturday. With Tata Martino leaving, of course, after the season ends, the big question is, you know, who will Atlanta bring in? Whether it's Guillermo Barros Scalotto, whether it's Sampoli, whether it's another coach. You mentioned Almirón. It looks like the team has PT Martinez from Argentina lined up to take his spot in the midfield. It was kind of rave reviews for his play with River Plate, or Boca Juniors, I beg your pardon, Boca Juniors. But, or maybe getting to mix up, I apologize. But PT Martinez, the player that is maybe slotted to replace Miguel Almirón. So we'll have to see what happens in the offseason. It should be a busy one for Atlanta United, looking for a new coach and possibly looking for a replacement for Miguel Almirón. But the question is, can they maintain that, even if they don't win MLS Cup, can they maintain their success in this league?
Absolutely. Last big question that we have for you, Sydney. It would not be a last word interview without asking you for a prediction. So feet to the fire. What happens on Saturday night at Mercedes-Benz Arena, and who's taking home MLS Cup 2018?
You know, coming into this matchup, I bet that Portland would be able to break down Atlanta and get that win. But, you know, the further the days have gone on, I've grown more confident in Atlanta United. It's definitely a different team than the one that drew Portland 1-1 earlier at Mercedes-Benz Stadium earlier in the season. If I'm to guess right now, I would say 2-0 win for Atlanta United on Saturday. As for goals, I would have to go with Jesus Martinez, of course, and Miguel Almirón in what might be his last appearance at Mercedes-Benz Stadium to go out on top. But again, you never know in this league. We'll see what happens. We'll see if Portland have a trick or two up their sleeve. But right now, we'll have to see Atlanta United winning the MLS Cup this year.
Absolutely. It is MLS Cups, and of course, the MLS scriptwriters are, of course, also the gods of chaos. Now, listeners, you can follow Sydney on Twitter at SHWrites, capital S, capital H, capital W. Check out all of his work on Atlanta United and Atlanta United 2 of the USL at Dirty South Soccer. And for those of you who are somewhat interested in college football, check out his work on the South Carolina Gamecocks at Garnet and Black Attack. Sydney, as customary, we give our guests the last word. Any closing thoughts, shameless plugs, etc. The floor is yours, my friend.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Now, if you're not a soccer fan, if you're probably listening to this podcast for the first time, I definitely encourage you to watch MLS Cup. 70,000 fans packed in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. One of the best teams in recent memory in MLS, in Atlanta United versus maybe the underdog in Portland Timbers. If you're a casual fan, if you're not sure about soccer, I'd encourage you to tune in. I think it'll be a very good advertisement for the league, and I, for one, am excited. I know everyone here at Atlanta is excited. I know the league's excited, so all that's left is to play the game.
Absolutely. We'll get to that. Listeners, we'll be right back where I will be joining, or Joe Hojnacki will be joining me from SBI Soccer to talk about the Portland Timbers side of things. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. My name is Matt Pollard. We just got done talking all things Atlanta United with Sydney Hunt of Dirty South Soccer. Now to talk about the Western Conference champions and the visiting team for MLS Cup 2018, I've brought in a good friend and former host of the show and former managing editor of Last Word on Soccer, Joe Hojnacki from SBI Soccer. Joe, how are you doing, my friend? It has been too long.
It really has. I mean, this is just like old times. It's been, what, a year and 9 months or so since I last appeared on these airwaves. So it's good to be back.
Excellent stuff. So I guess first of all, I have to get an update. How are you doing? Any hot takes that you have on Detroit City? And I believe when we last parted ways, you were just entering playing intramural co-ed soccer, and I think I predicted you would score 4 goals on the season. Do you remember your stats from that season at all?
I could tell you that. Yeah, I had 1 goal that season. It came in a playoff game. I did not have any yellow cards. I think you predicted 3 yellow cards in 10 games for me, which thank God that didn't happen. But yeah, I had 1 goal, came in a playoff game, so it came when it mattered the most. Yeah, we still ended up losing that game. I don't remember the score.
Oh, okay. Well, you're Darren Spree, you're Darren Spree, if nothing else, right?
Yeah, sure, we'll go with that.
Okay. Any hot takes on Detroit City to discuss? Is there, you know, entering somewhat of the new format with the NPSL?
I'm excited to see what this new format breeds. It's going to be a high level of soccer, the highest level of soccer played in the city since the 1970s. So I'm kind of excited to see how this all works out, how this new NPSL Pro League is going to be, and to see teams like the New York Cosmos and Miami FC come through Keyworth Stadium and get heckled by the Northern Guard and the rest of Detroit City's faithful.
Oh, excellent. I love it. But let's get on to things MLS-related. First of all, Joe, Portland Timbers making it back to their first MLS Cup since 2015, and I would argue that most people would have had them doing so with being slight underdogs. I think a lot of people might have liked the Seattle Sounders in that game, having home field advantage, and certainly I think a lot of people would have pegged Sporting Kansas City to get a win last Thursday at Children's Mercy Park, but the Portland Timbers playing extremely effective soccer, playing extremely timely soccer, and Giovanni Savarese has his club playing well, and in particular has their best players playing their best soccer of the year. Your thoughts on the Timbers making it back to MLS Cup?
Yeah, they've definitely been underdogs, and I would even stretch it beyond that Sounders match and say that they were underdogs in the knockout round against FC Dallas. For a team that did not play well on the road for the past couple of years, it's just kind of strange that in the playoffs now, they're playing their best soccer away from home. I mean, the first leg against the Sounders is a solid 2-1 win, but it wasn't particularly impressive, unlike the second leg, which was probably the most exciting MLS playoff game that I've ever watched. And the same thing is a bland draw 0-0 at Providence Park against Sporting Kansas City. And then they went in there and probably played their best game of the year in that second leg. They did exactly what they had to do. They had to defend first because they knew SKC was going to come out and attack. And then in the second half, when they were down a goal, their playmakers took over. It was Diego Valeri. It was Sebastian Blanco. And then just they did what they had to do. They counterattacked hard, and their playmakers made the plays they had to do, and they got through. They got a little lucky, too, I think. Zarek Valentin probably should have been sent off for a second yellow late in that game, but the referee decided not to do it, and they stuck out, had 11 players the whole game, and held out in the grand scheme of things.
Excellent stuff. Let's look big picture at Giovanni Savarese's first year coaching in MLS. I would say the Timbers maybe came in with a little bit of tempered expectations coming into 2018. The core was a little bit older. Darlan Tignagbe had departed in the offseason. There were questions at some point during that offseason, during the winter from 2017 to 2018 about Fernando Adi's future. Was he interested in leaving? Was he checked out mentally, and who would maybe fill that role? Up top from the forward position, and Giovanni Savarese was going to bring a new flavor to the team. You know, they adopted the Christmas tree formation throughout the year they had. I don't remember if it broke the 2013 record they set for most games unbeaten in league play. Feel free to correct me on that, but then ultimately play well, you know, down the stretch to get into the playoffs and are obviously, you know, Western Conference champions. Again, your thoughts on the first year in Giovanni Savarese, when I would argue that they overachieved just to get this far?
They kind of did. The first part of the season, kind of really into the beginning parts of the summer, it was a lot of trial and error for Savarese and the Timbers in general. And what's kind of funny is you mentioned the Christmas tree formation, you mentioned Fernando Adi, you mentioned the loss of Darlan Tignagbe, and in the grand scheme of things, Savarese really ended up in kind of the same place tactically that they were when he came in there. That they were using for much of last season and the seasons before. Darlan Tignagbe was more or less replaced by Andy Polo, who's essentially Darlan Tignagbe with a little bit less passing efficiency, but a little more speed and playmaking ability. Fernando Adi, sold off to FC Cincinnati midseason, has kind of been replaced by Jeremy Abobase, who may be a little shorter, a little less physical, but he still kind of fulfills the same sort of role. So it's interesting in that Savarese has tried to remake the team, but essentially turned them back into what they were before he arrived. I mean, he's essentially using very similar tactics to Caleb Porter, but it's working. The players that have lost have been easily replaced. And and then it's the veterans. It's Valeri, it's Chara, it's Sebastian Blanco, who have taken over and helped lead the team in the split second on field decision making. So yeah, Savarese is a great coach in the sense that he tried a few things, but in the end, he just went with what worked last year and let his playmakers take over.
Absolutely. Let's get into the actual game itself, MLS Cup. I've heard a couple of different names for this group. I have coined them as the Timbers Holy Trinity. Feel free to correct me if there's a different nomenclature that Timbers Twitter is using in general in referring to, of course, Diego Valeri, Sebastian Blanco, and Diego Chara. I think this final, Dan, is very simple in terms of what you expect to see from the Timbers. I think they're going to sit deep. They're going to let Atlanta give them the ball. Diego Chara is going to do his things in the middle of the park, and then they're going to try and break and hit them on the counter, preferably when Atlanta has numbers up front. We've seen Atlanta, particularly down the stretch, certainly against the New York Red Bulls, be extremely effective off the counterattack. That's not really going to happen when you have a road team in MLS Cup voluntarily giving you the ball. What do you see tactically in how the Timbers approach this game, how they, try and attack Atlanta on the offensive side of things, and how the heck does someone stop Miguel Almiron and Justin Martinez? Because nobody has yet.
Yeah. Right. Well, on one hand, I do think that Atlanta's just unrelenting attack does play to a Portland strength in the sense that you're right. Portland doesn't like to have the ball. They like to quick counterattacks. And you've seen teams like Sporting Kansas City, when they let Portland have the ball, the Timbers don't really know what to do. So it kind of plays to a Portland strength in the fact that there's Atlanta, who also likes to play with the ball and isn't really known for as strong of a defense as Sporting Kansas City is. So I think that'll work, but the problem is, in order for them to get the ball back, you got to stop Almiron, Martinez, and that entire crew. And that's where it's been going to be kind of troublesome for them. Portland is playing their best defense of the year. It looks like Liam Ridgewell, despite the fact that he's showing his age, is starting to come out of his funk, his injury-riddled season. He's settled back into that back line. Whether or not Laris Mabiala can play, he is not trained completely with the first team yet, so he's sort of a question mark right now. Bill Tuiloma has done well in his absence, but he's still not quite the same force in the middle that Laris Mabiala is. And Mabiala, the fact that he's one of the leading goal scorers among defenders in MLS. He's such a threat on set pieces with his heading ability. Another thing that they're going to kind of miss there. Wide defending, I am not too concerned about that. Jorge Villafana, U.S. international, leading fullback in MLS, in my opinion. And then Zarek Valentin, very physical player, excellent defender, and he's got Alvis Powell to back him up just in case something goes wrong there. So that's kind of how you got to do it, is you got to rely on the guys who got you there. Don't try to be too aggressive. Don't get too stuck in. Don't go to ground very often. Just kind of stick with them. You can't really stop Almiron and Martinez. You just got to hope you can contain them and hope they don't hurt you too hard.
Absolutely. Set pieces have been a big deal for both of these teams at times. We know what Atlanta can do depending on who's standing over a free kick, and I think certainly that could be something that the Timbers look to take advantage of with Diego Valeri, and particularly the fact that they'll be counterattacking for much of the game, that might be counterattacking to, well, if you can't create a chance, then at least sort of draw a foul. How much do you see that playing a role? As my esteemed ginger colleague, Alexi Lawless, would say, are we approaching a potential set piece orgy?
I would hope not, because I think if it comes down to that, I think Atlanta's going to win for sure. And kind of just, You're gonna have to avoid giving up set pieces. You're gonna have to avoid fouling in the final third, because Almiron and Martinez, whoever takes one of those free kicks, has a fairly strong percentage chance of scoring. Granted, the same thing could kind of be said for the Timbers, where you have both Blanco and Valeri who can hit him indirectly. If Mabiala is playing, he can head in a nice cross or a floated in free kick, something like that. And the same thing can be said about Liam Ridgewell, despite the fact that he's getting older in age, he doesn't seem to be able to do that quite as well anymore. I don't want a set piece orgy. I want to see both of these two teams show off what they can do in open play, because both teams are capable of doing a lot. So I hope there's not a hack and attacker game, but you never know what can happen.
of course, let's move on to what's going on immediately outside, or I guess outside the lines, but still very much in the stadium. The atmosphere at Mercedes-Benz Arena is going to be absolutely rocking. I think I saw a report today that tickets on the secondary market are going upwards of $250 per seat, at the minimum. It's already been announced as a sellout. You know, I'm not sure what Atlanta's doing in terms of standing room only that might make it a new attendance record for them and the league by, you know, 30 or 40 or possibly more. I just got done talking with Sidney Hunt, where he maybe isn't expecting the Timbers to be rattled by this atmosphere. They've already visited Mercedes-Benz earlier this year, got a 1-1 draw, and the atmosphere they'll be experiencing isn't that much unlike CenturyLink, which they're very, very familiar with, and you don't have the issue of getting used to turf because the Timbers regularly practice and play on turf. What do you see from an atmosphere standpoint, and how do you see the Timbers potentially trying to manage that home crowd?
I'm looking forward to this from an atmospheric perspective. It's going to be the largest crowd in MLS Cup history. It's going to be the largest crowd the Timbers have ever played in front of, because, yeah, they've played in front of a sold-out CenturyLink, but that's got about 10,000 fewer fans than what you're probably going to see on Saturday night at Mercedes-Benz. It's going to be an excellent advertisement for MLS, I'm telling you that, because it's going to be a ruckus crowd, it's going to be a loud crowd. You're going to have Atlanta's Terminus Legion kind of leading the way, but you're also going to have 1,300, I believe the Timbers Army got 1,300 tickets, and you know they're going to be Timbers fans scoping out seats on the secondary market. So the Timbers are going to have a presence there too. It's going to be a lot like a Seattle game, and I think Portland will be fine in terms of not letting the hostile crowd bother them all that much.
Good stuff. Let's go to, let's talk about legacy implications. Obviously, a big deal for Atlanta sort of planting their flag, you know, as the flagship representative organization of the MLS 3.0 era. On the other side, you look at, you know, certainly, you know, not that Diego Valeri could be any more Mr. Timber than he already is, but certainly planting in his legacy. I would throw Diego Chará into that category. You would have Giovanni Savarese winning an MLS Cup in his first year, at a new club that I'm off the top of my head, maybe just Bob Bradley in terms of first year head coach in the league. Well, I guess in 96 with Bruce Arena, just because at that point nobody coached in MLS because the league hadn't existed then. What does this MLS Cup mean in the context of the legacy of the Timbers as a club, and in particular the group that would actually be accomplishing it on the field?
Well, players like Valeri and Chara and even Liam Ridgewell, they're already royalty. They're already the kings of soccer in Portland. A win on Saturday would make them the emperors of soccer, if I can use that analogy of heraldry there. They already rule the city, it seems. And Savarese winning a MLS Cup in his first season would just be amazing. It'd be, yeah, we all kind of missed Caleb Porter, but at the same time, he was getting a little stale. It looked like he wasn't quite able to find a winning combination anymore, and then Savarese just pops in and does it in his first season. I mean, the fact that he's gotten them to MLS Cup is enough to say, you know what, you can stick around for as long as you want to be here. So I think reputation-wise for him, I mean, he has very little to lose right now, but a hell of a lot to gain. And as far as just the club in general, I mean, Portland's already one of the cities that has celebrated an MLS Cup like other American cities would celebrate their team winning a World Series or a Stanley Cup or something like that. So it would just bring Portland even more just into the center of what that city is and galvanize their fan support for them. It's already one of the most dedicated supporters, clubs in the entire league. So yeah, it's going to mean quite a lot for the club, the fans, and these players if they can win, especially now, because I feel like in 2015, they were slight favorites over the Columbus Crew when they went into that game. I don't think anyone is surprised with how that one went. This year, I don't think too many people are expecting them to win. So if they can turn around those expectations and get a win in a very hostile environment against one of the best teams MLS has ever seen, it would turn this team into a very, very important figure historically.
Joe, you know that it would not be a Last Word SC interview without asking a guest for a prediction. So MLS Cup this coming Saturday at Mercedes-Benz Arena. It will be at 8 p.m. Eastern. You will be on location, yes?
Yes, I will be. I'm flying down to Atlanta Thursday morning. Hopefully going to make it in time for some media availability. If not, I'll just kind of chill in Atlanta for the day. I hear it's a fine city. So, yes, I will be down there. Prediction for the game. I know I'm supposed to, you know, pimp the Timbers in their cause, but Atlanta's such a good team. I think there'll be some goals. I think Atlanta wins the game 3-1.
I think that's probably a fair result. If you've got some free time, Joe, when I actually visited as part of the basketball band for the ACC tournament when that was in Atlanta, we headed out to I don't know if it's Vortex Burger or Vortex Bar and Grill, but kind of this crazy sort of hybrid, like how you would have like a peanut butter and jelly burger, but that it actually works. Like that kind of stuff is basically their entire menu. And so like there was a soy teriyaki, something like everything was crazy and felt like it totally wouldn't work as a hamburger like food combination out of like the Family Guy episode where Peter starts a food truck that's all like hybrid food that he just makes of the stuff that he wants to eat. It all sounds weird. It's all amazing. I haven't heard of anybody who went there who didn't like something that they tried. Vortex Bar and Grill. But in any case, listeners, you can follow Joe on Twitter at SportsDeskJoe. Check out all of his writing, Timbers related or otherwise, at SBI Soccer. Joe, per last word on soccer tradition, we give our guests the last word. The floor is yours if you have any shameless plugs or if you want to say anything about MLS Cup or otherwise that you have not already brought about. Greg Berhalter, hot takes, welcome.
I don't have any Greg Berhalter hot takes quite yet. I'm still just mad about the fact that it took them so dang long to hire him. Why couldn't they have hired him a year ago? I don't know. It's not, he's been the favorite the whole time. But anyway, that's setting aside my distaste for the administration of the U.S. men's national team right now. It's good to be to make a guest appearance back in my old stomping grounds. Last word has always been great to me. Got me started there shortly after the Timbers' last MLS Cup run is when I started writing over there, and I took over co-managing editor duties with you shortly after I started. So that following summer, right around Copa America time, if memory serves me correctly. Good to make an appearance back there again. Check me out at SBI Soccer. Been working hard there, probably harder than I should be, but whatever. I don't need free time. I have fun doing what I do. So yeah. I'm also just really excited to check out Mercedes-Benz Stadium. That place just looks fantastic. So I'm excited to get down there and excited to watch the Timbers and cover the Timbers in an MLS Cup.
Possibly a good omen then, since we had you back on the podcast right around the time that the Timbers were winning their first MLS Cup. Joe, thank you very much for your time. Listeners, we'll be right back at the roundtable where myself and a combination of Robert Kerr and Daniel Sperry will be previewing MLS Cup and finally giving you our pick-ems for this coming Saturday final. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com. It is time for the roundtable, where we will be doing our preview of MLS Cup 2018, talking some other major American soccer news and notes, and of course, doing pick-ems for the big final on Saturday at Mercedes-Benz Arena. But first, Daniel Sperry, Robert Kerr, Dan, how are you doing?
Good.
Robert, how are you doing?
Still hanging in there, Chief.
Excellent stuff. Okay, guys, let's get into it. Everybody who's looked at this matchup kind of sees it as certainly Portland Timbers being an underdog, Atlanta certainly being the overwhelming favorite. That's what 538.com thinks. That's what Vegas, from what I checked last, thinks about it. I think it's pretty simple from a tactical perspective. Portland Timbers are going to come in and have that low block, just like they've had success all season long under Giovanni Savarese. They're going to try and counter against Atlanta United, and Atlanta's going to kind of have to go back to what they were good at their start of their MLS tenure, possessing the ball and pinging it around and overloading their opponent rather than them trying to be the counter-attacking team as we saw them have success against the two New York teams in the playoffs. Dan, convince me otherwise or tell me how that this thing is going to shake out and what the key matchups are going to be around the field.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones actually is within the midfield three of Atlanta and the midfield three of Portland. I'm really intrigued to kind of see how that plays out, because you have Diego Valeri, you have Miguel Almiron, then you have Diego Chara and Darlington Nagbe, and you've got potentially David Guzman, goodness, who's going to be in the midfield? It's either going to be Remedy or will Lorenowitz kind of be in there, you know, roving around as a destroyer. That's going to be really interesting to me, the whole thing, that midfield matchup. I will be more intrigued to see how Portland kind of handles Darlington Nagbe, knowing that, you know, knowing how well they know him, and all of that kind of stuff. It'd be fun to watch Diego Chara and Darlington Nagbe kind of all over each other. That'd be a lot of fun, just for the giggles and all that, and see if Darlington Nagbe likes being on the other end of, some of the Diego Chara nasties at the end of plays and stuff like that. So I think that midfield battle is going to come down to it there. Is, you know, who bosses that midfield area? Because I think if you shut off the midfield for Atlanta United, you really shut off, the creativity for them. You can get the chances to, Tito Villalba isn't as much of a chance creator for them as Darlington Nagbe and Miguel Almiron are. So if Portland, you know, can kind of lock down, even ignore Jeff Lorenowitz, if you just put, David Guzman and Diego Chara on, Almiron and on, Darlington Nagbe, I think you kind of do a decent amount of kind of shutting off the creativity valve in the midfield for, Atlanta United. So that could be a really big matchup to watch. I think that's probably the biggest one for me, because both teams do, their fullbacks do a really good job of managing, how teams get in behind and using the space behind them. I don't think either team has necessarily a winger that I'm like, that if I'm, if I'm Zarek Valentin, I don't think handling Tito Villalba, trying to get him behind you, is really a whole lot of different from, you know, managing Daniel Shalloway or any of those guys kind of running at you. I think it's a lot of the same. It's something that he should be able to handle, at least for a little bit. Until he gets close to picking up a second yellow card, then they can throw on Elvis Powell again. I think that the fullback space isn't really a whole lot. Joseph Martinez is a lot to handle, but you've got some really experienced center backs for Portland. So I really think it all kind of comes down to that midfield battle between either team and, how does, Portland shut off that creativity valve? Because I think, Atlanta, talent wise, you know, I think they're going to take much more advantage of the chances than Sporting Kansas City was able to. It's no secret that Atlanta United is the more talented team in the attack. It's not, you know, anything critical to Sporting Kansas City. It just is. I think managing how those chances get there and what type of chances they create, is going to be the key for Portland if they're going to do anything.
Robert, how do you see this game shaking down tactically, and how do you think both managers will approach it?
Daniel spelled out the tactics pretty thoroughly there, but if I go just in generalities, I mean, this is an awesome matchup, really. I think you got a proactive Atlanta and then the reactive Portland, and I think that the game is going to loom largely on the protagonist in this, like, Atlanta, if they score early, I think that it could get out of hand. It's such a great matchup because I could, in my head, see so many different scenarios of it going different ways. Atlanta, they score early, it could turn into a rout. Atlanta, you know, doesn't score in the first half. I could see them maybe getting frustrated and then allowing Portland's somewhat reactive and counterattacking approach, you know, get on top. So I really think that it all depends on that first half, if Atlanta's are frustrated or if they are growing into the game.
No, I agree with you. Dan, I agree with you in particular that I think it's going to be all about what happens in the midfield. I think if the Portland Timbers are able to muck it up and stymie Atlanta enough, and in particular intercept what's going on from a wide perspective, I wouldn't be shocked if we see Julian Gressel in a wide role for much of this game, even if he doesn't start in that particular position. I'm really curious to see what the Timbers do from a fullback perspective. I think Jorge Villafañe is going to be serviceable, but what's going on in that that right back position, given, you know, what, you know, some of the weaknesses that Zarek Valentin has shown throughout this entire year, and in particular in over the course of the two legs against Sporting Kansas City. You know, soccer can be a game of weaknesses at some point, and eventually if you get to asking enough questions on the weakest point in that Portland Timbers Dan, eventually you're going to crack wood and then find, you know, and then find pay dirt. So, is Portland in their defensive low block? Are they able to just stop everything that's going on from, you know, whoever is in that midfield three from getting the ball to Miguel Almiron and Joseph Martinez? Are the wide players on either side able to win those individual battles? I think that's where the initial confrontation is going to be in there, just because of the fact that Atlanta is going to have most of the ball and they're going to have to be on the front foot, being the home team and the better team and the more talented, I would say for the most part, better coach team going into this final. And then on the flip side, how does that transition into the counterattack for Portland Timbers? If Atlanta are able to overload the box for certain areas with numbers, are they able to ping the ball around and disrupt Portland from their shape, or take advantage of an individual matchup, whether that's Joseph Martinez on either of the center backs, Miguel Almiron against Diego Chará, or any of the wide players against their opposite number, then I think that's advantage Atlanta United. If the Portland Timbers are able to stymie them enough and then win the ball to then where Chicago, Diego Chará can then move the ball into an advantageous position, then the counterattack is on. Diego Valeri, Sebastian Blanco all day. We'll see whether or not that can happen. I think the cagier and the more nervous the affair starts, I would say advantage Portland Timbers, and I think the longer that it goes scoreless, it's advantage Portland Timbers. If I'm Atlanta United, I'm trying to get a goal by any means necessary in the opening 30 minutes, just because then that's going to open up the Portland Timbers to have to come out of their shell to try and attack down a goal. I think that would make for a more exciting affair as a tactics nerd. I don't know that that would be a better one, just because seeing some of the nuances of how Giovanni Savarese, you know, will try to, you know, play the cat and mouse game with Tata Martino if it's still a close affair, rather than a back and forth run and gun sort of thing where you've basically got, you know, almost like overtime 3-on-3 hockey, where in the NHL, you know, where one team tries to counter and then either they score or they then spring the opponent for a counterattack that could make for exciting soccer. I don't know necessarily as great quality, just because that's not what either of these two teams, I don't know if that suits the two teams in terms of putting their best players in a position to be successful over the course of 90 minutes. It'd be chaos. It would be fun. I don't know that it would be easy to draw a narrative out there from a journalistic standpoint. Robert, I'll throw it to you. Is there anything else that we haven't said about this MLS Cup preview?
I just think it's a fascinating matchup, really. I mean, one of the preseason favorites, hosting and matching up against a team that I only know one Portland Timbers fan personally, and he never believed that they'd be here. So, and he doesn't believe that they have a chance on Saturday, but I mean, we didn't see him getting this far. So there's the why not Portland aspect to it. So it's the the luck of the draw on a one game elimination game versus, you know, the team that was better over the long season. So, I mean, two very obviously very highly competent South American managers meeting up in that cat and mouse game. It should be quite a spectacle.
Let's move on, guys. Probably the worst kept secret in at least the last decade, as far as I'm concerned, in all of American soccer. Earlier today, Greg Berhalter was announced as the new manager of the United States men's national team at the senior level. Finally, Dan, you know, you and I have pontificated about the process and the pros and cons and why it took so long and the frustrations and the meaningless friendlies and everything, but now U.S. soccer finally has their man. Some questions about the process in terms of the number of candidates they were interviewing, just approaching it from it's Greg Berhalter unless he gives us another reason not to go with him. You know, it was Greg Berhalter's job to lose, but now they finally have their manager, and Berhalter has had some time with the media to talk about how he sees the path for the U.S. national team. Is there anything different? Is there anything that you have to say that we haven't said over the course of the last 9 months about the prospects of Berhalter taking over this team going into 2019?
Yeah, I think so. I think for me, at least, I don't know if it's something that I haven't said yet, but I think it's nice to hear something from him on like how he sees the team going forward and the playing style. Brian Soretta, you can find it on Twitter. posted a really good, kind of posted a whole quote from him, and this was when he was asked about what we can expect from the American team and what's the idea behind him. And this is the quote that says, I'll just read the quote and I'll let this kind of stand, but the idea is that we're an attacking-based team. This is Berhalter speaking about the idea of what the U.S. men's national team should look like. But the idea is that we're an attacking-based team that wants to create goal-scoring opportunities by disorganizing the opponent. We'll do that in a number of different ways. What I'd say is that consistently over my time at Columbus, we've done it through build-up, where we start with the ball at the back and the team tries to press this and we play through to try to create goal-scoring opportunities. We're making the field big. Another way to do that is use pressure, whether we start in the mid block or move into high pressure or force turnovers and win the ball and immediately create goal scoring opportunities. The idea is that it's a fluid style, that the players are intent on breaking lines, playing through the opponent and creating goal scoring opportunities. At times we can do a better job changing the tempo instead of playing at such a high rhythm all the time. I think mixing that rhythm is going to be very important, especially at the international level and especially given the climates we are going to be playing in. But we want to see ball circulation, breaking lines, and creating goal-scoring opportunities. That should be the DNA of this team. I think that's one thing with the Columbus Crew that I've seen over the last, you know, since I really go back to since 2014, is that he has always, always, always had them setting up goal-scoring chances. Whether or not they are finishing them is a different thing, and I think a lot of it comes down to just personnel for that standpoint. But there's no doubt in my mind that Berhalter is able to get teams to create chances and score goals and play an optically good soccer and a results good soccer. Because I think the results really do speak for him in Columbus over the last few years. So, you know, to hear him articulate what he wants to see from this team and the type of things that we can expect, is great because, you know, like this is the closest thing to any kind of direction that we've had, honestly, since Bob Bradley. Like, we knew what we were getting when Bob Bradley was the head coach. We were going to play as a 4-4-2. We were going to absorb some pressure and then we were going to play on the counter and we were going to create some dynamite goal scoring opportunities. Whether or not they were less or more goal scoring opportunities than the opponent is a different story, but we always created solid chances. And then for years, it has always been, we're going to do this. I want to see more bite out of the players. So, you know, we're going to play our best players kind of a thing. And it's all these other mumbo jumbo things instead of like the actual soccer. Like, what are we going to see? What do we need to expect out of the U.S. men's national team? And to get a hard quote on what that's going to be like, I think is massive. And I think a really good thing for all of us to kind of look forward to the future for. Cause I, for one, am very excited if Berhalter can get the U.S. men's national team to optically look like the Columbus Crew did and then just actually finish the chances because they have dudes who can actually finish the chances on this squad, I think that's a big thing.
Robert, you had a really, in hindsight, salient quote maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago when the U.S. national team was kind of teetering. I think it was going into that final two match days in the CONCACAF hexagonal, commenting on, you know, the prospects of the U.S. national team missing the World Cup and in particular reflecting on your own experience with the Three Lions and them missing the World Cup and what it took for them to sort of learn those lessons and approach things differently that ultimately led to improved success with Gareth Southgate and, you know, a relative group of babies in the 2018 World Cup. Your thoughts on the Berhalter appointment, and in particular, has U.S. soccer learned anything from their mistakes that makes you think they'll be able to replicate what the Three Lions have done since missing the World Cup?
I think that the U.S. Might have done the right thing. In spite of all their efforts, I think they actually might have got the right person for the job, because for what Daniel was saying, like, they created tons of chances. Imagine how many goals that Columbus would have scored had, like, Justin Miram, you know, like, had an improved, you know, strike rate. I mean, because he seemed to always have chances and miss them, and it just seemed like an example, and they knew what they were doing. And then just, like, you know, the bar is set pretty low, but at this point, the United States men's national team having a plan that's solid is a great move forward. And like you said, with Gareth Southgate, you know, there was a plan put in there, and they're following it. And they took the egos out. You know, I don't know if it's the same exact problems. It could be just different sort of actors. But Southgate seemed to have removed the agents and the people calling for their player, or, you know, certain players of clout to be called in, this and the other. And Southgate seems to be just, like, you know, doing the game. And hopefully we get into that. But the press conference today, my eyes started hurting from all the eye rolling I did from like the company type speak. But I think that Berhalter and his comments today freed us from one of our word selection or word slips that we do. Because, you know, in this whole soccer football world we live in, word selection, you can be struck down for it. So the brand new coach for our men's national team, in his comments, uttered the term the MLS. So I feel like we can just stop giving people a runaround about saying the MLS. Thank you, Coach Berhalter.
I agree.
Finally ended it.
Yeah, I'll close out the rapid-fire topics that we have for today, guys, with the news that Tyler Adams, much rumored, was going to be heading to Red Bull Leipzig with the departure of Jesse March earlier this season and the end of the MLS season. That is now official, so he'll be transferring from New York Red Bulls to Red Bulls Leipzig, or I don't know if it's Leipzig Red Bulls. You know what I'm talking about, listeners. New York Red Bulls chose, per club policy, to not release any information regarding the details of the deal, and there is a little bit of hullabaloo amongst New York Red Bulls Twitter regarding what that transfer fee potentially was. I mean, as I was speaking with a few people in the know, based on the rules with MLS, the first $750,000 goes to straight allocation money, the general allocation money that the club can use in any way that general allocation money can be used. But then after that, that money can go to other different things. You can't convert it just straight to GAM. You can't convert it into TAM or anything that has to be used in other infrastructure. And basically anything over that $750,000 would basically be the same ownership group just taking money from one of its clubs and then putting it back into its pocket. So I certainly think that transfer fee should be commensurate with Tyler Adams' value. And even if it, you know, even if it was only $750,000, I would like to see, at least amongst the general Red Bulls, you know, discussion with the mothership, that the production of Tyler Adams and what he was able to do for the New York team, proof of concept that he represents or that he has continued to build upon the Matt Miazgas of the world and the other homegrowns that they've had, proof that if you put money into the system, it will continue to yield results, that even if the transfer fee was not commensurate with what Tyler Adams' value would be on the open market, going from one club that with a completely different ownership group to another European, to a European club with a completely different ownership group from the MLS team, that I would like to see that there is a commitment of funding to say, okay, we know that this is proven, you know, we as the Red Bulls organization haven't spent as much money on our MLS-based club in the last couple of years with the departure of Thierry Henry and Tim Cahill, et cetera, but this is a proof to where we're going to give that club the allocation money to then spend how that entity chooses to prefer, and then also invest money into the club elsewhere, possibly in a new designated player, possibly in some help for BWP, or at the very least pumping in more money into that academy machine that continues to churn out MLS quality talent. So independent of what that transfer fee is, I hope that the league would have pushed to say that, you know, that should be commensurate, because I think where the league is at a point where, in order for it to grow, the players that are being sold are going to have to be sold for market value, not a cheaper value, because, you know, they come with an American passport, and those assets are going to have to prove themselves across in Europe. And I think as a selling league, you have to start, you know, you have to start establishing yourself as saying that, no, we want market value for what this player is worth because we see the value in that, and then that sets a precedent for the future market. I realize this is a, in the context of other European of players going to Europe, whether that's Miguel Almiron in January or Zach Steffen, who just made the move or who will be making the move to Manchester City, I think this is definitely an outlier just because these are two, you know, these are two clubs that have the same ownership group. So effectively, it's just transferring one asset from the other. You know, it's not that dissimilar, I would say, you know, from, you know, a player in AAA baseball moving up to the show, you know, after the roster expansion at the end of the season. Whereas I would say, you know, other than New York City FC and City Football Group, there's really no other relationship in which you wouldn't get a public release of that information, and that there would not be bargaining chips for the there would not be a bargaining or haggling element for the MLS team to get market value, because it'd be two separate ownership groups and an actual exchange of more than $750,000 in general allocation money. Okay, guys, it is time to go to our pick'ems finally for MLS Cup. It will be taking place this Saturday, December 8th, 2018. 15, 8 p.m. Eastern on Big Fox, Bart Simpson Fox, at Mercedes-Benz Arena in Atlanta, Georgia. Dan, I will start with you. Who you got and why? How does this thing go out? Extra time, no extra time? And I guess who's winning the MVP of the of MLS Cup 2018?
I'm going to go with a 3-1 win for Atlanta United on their home turf. I think the MVP is going to come down to Miguel Almiron for Atlanta United. I see his quality and his talent and everything just kind of being the type that will transcend in a game like this. Whether he may not score all the goals by but he's definitely good for a few assists in this one. And I think you're going to see a lot of good things from this Atlanta United team. I think if Portland has any type of, first 40 minutes like they did against Sporting Kansas City, but with Atlanta United, I think the scoreline could be 2-3 at halftime. So, I think at home, it's going to be overwhelming, for Atlanta. And I think they're just going to get the job done. I predicted at the beginning of the year, I said Atlanta United, and Sporting Kansas City for the supporter, for the MLS Cup final. I had said Sporting Kansas City would have been the supporter shield, but that didn't happen. But I was really close to getting that final prediction correct. However, I believe I picked Atlanta to win that one because Atlanta. And so I'm going to continue to stick with Atlanta as my champion.
Robert, who you got and why, and who's winning MLS MVP?
Who's winning and why? I got to say, before I get to that, I'd say thank you for letting me on the final pick'ems of the 2018 calendar. I feel like we should have like the Titanic song underneath us here. it's a hard pick'em. I mean, the matchup is balanced well. I mean, there's so many scenarios of what could happen have gone through my head. But I think that if I'm going to really get in my gut feeling, I think that Ezequiel Barco is going to score the winning goal in the game. And I think he's going to have like a coming of age moment in the final, which will lead into him having a big 2019. I think that I hate to parrot the score, but it's hard to pick against Portland because they've defied the odds so far. But I'm going to go 3-1 Atlanta with Martinez getting the first one, Barco getting the ultimate winner, and another one late to set off the fireworks and explosions in an Atlanta-heavy stadium.
And the train, I don't know if it's a whistle, a siren, a horn, the train noise that they make when Atlanta scores, and when the very few times that the Atlanta Falcons actually score touchdowns as well. I'm going to agree with you guys both in the result and the final scoreline. I think it will be 3-1 to Atlanta United. I think it'll be a comprehensive performance and result for them. I think they'll come out and they'll score first. I think the Portland Timbers get a goal maybe just before halftime on the counter as Atlanta's pushing to try and put in that final dagger. And then I'll say that it's going to be Joseph Martinez with the winner, and then maybe a garbage time goal in the last 10 to 15 minutes. You know, maybe Giovanni Savarese has to get creative with a substitution or a tactical change in order to try to get back into the match. That'll cause Portland to be exposed at the back end. Miguel Marone and Joseph Martinez will do what they do. In terms of MVP, I'll say that Miguel Marone will have the better of the 90-minute performance, but MLS Media being MLS Media, because Joseph Martinez will score the game and the championship-winning goal, the second goal for Atlanta, I think he'll get it independent of who's scoring the other two or how many assists Miguel Almiron will have in the game. So it'll be 3-1 Atlanta. Of course, since we all picked the exact same things, that means that's not what is going to happen, because that's how MLS pick-ups work. It's going to be a different scoreline, but it's time for last words. Robert, I will start with you. Where can people find you on Twitter, and do you have any last words?
You can find me at LWOSR2Kurtu on the Twitter.com. I may come out with a lower league Michigan manifesto. Lots of teams changing leagues, changing towns, changing rebrands, and going away and then coming back. So lots of talk about a lot of teams going different ways in what is a very active and, lot. Like, there's no professional teams in Detroit. There's going to be the first one in Lansing. But I'll probably be coming out with some sort of article on lower league soccer in Michigan at Last Word on Sports. Albion.com very soon. Thank you guys for having me back.
Thank you, Robert. Dan, last words to you.
Nothing else beyond what I talked about at the end of the first segment, but I will say thanks to all those who have listened throughout the year, supported us by reading articles and interacting with us on Twitter and everywhere else. It's been very nice to this season to deal with all the coverage and everything that we've been doing. Comes all down to the end on Sunday. For me and my team and my coverage is pretty much done, but it is very nice to hit the end point and kind of celebrate the season that was with the heck of a matchup on Saturday. So tune in, interact with us one more time through game day. And again, thanks all for listening throughout the whole season.
Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWS Matt Pollard. As news was kind of breaking out on Monday, a DJ at the FIFA annual awards asked Ada Hergerberg, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the first ever women's golden ball winner, to do a twerk at the end of her award speech, and she I think appropriate nasty woman in a good way approach to it, just sort of shoved it off. Hashtag don't cross the line. That's all I really have to say about that. The objectification of women apparently is still alive in 2018. It has no place in the beautiful game. It has no place in a developed, advanced society such as ours or anywhere in Europe, as far as I'm concerned. Listeners, check out all of our content at Last Word on soccer.com all season long. Check us out across all social media platforms at Last Word SC. You can subscribe to Last Word Soccer Club Radio anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Last Word on Sports Radio. You'll find us and a whole bunch of other great stuff from our Last Word on Sports family. Thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group, your team, or just yourself at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, we see you next week where we will recap MLS Cup 2018, everything that happened, and look ahead to the 2018-2019 winter offseason for MLS. We'll see you next time.